Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2011. Lecture 8, delivered on February 10, 2011. The title of this lecture is Ratio Analysis.
Today, Ratio Analysis. In this lecture, I will show you the formulas. And then for the weekend, I will encourage you to apply those formulas to financial statements that I will provide for you, either as an Excel spreadsheet or as a static PDF file. The first ratios, and we group ratios into classifications, and the first ones that I talk about are the profitability ratios. And the reason you talk about these is simply that these are the ones you would hear the most popularly talked about. Well, the gross margin is, the net margin is. And so we have the gross margin. And the gross margin would be net income. I'm sorry, gross income, duh. Over your sales. Gross income over sales. In other words, you take your sales minus your cost of goods sold, and that gets you your gross margin. Now, this one, of course, wouldn't apply in a service type of business. It would be only if there was a COGS line. Now, the gross margin essentially tells you, after you've paid for the physicality of the materials that created your sales, your revenue, what do you got left? Now, the gross margin, as all ratios, can be all over the board. In some cases, you've got gross margins that are 80%, 90%. In other cases, you have gross margins that are maybe 10, 15, 20%. It depends upon the industry. In some industries, the markup is not very much over what things cost you. In other industries, ideally, we have a pretty robust markup. So, for example, if I were to tell you in a business that I had, one of my businesses, that my markup was 400%, you might think to me, well, you greedy bastard. In other words, I'd have $100 of sales, and the stuff would have cost me, in one case, about $20, just to give you an example. So there you are. My gross profit would have been $100 minus $20 or $80. So my gross margin would have been 80%. Sounds like I'm doing something obscene. That's a huge markup, right? Not by the time you get to the stupid bottom line, because you've got all these bills to pay. You'd be surprised how fast those expenses are going to chew up that nice fat gross margin you've got. So just because you've got a fat gross margin doesn't mean you're a greedy bastard, and it doesn't mean that you're doing great either, because you have to understand that that gross margin is going to get shaved down a lot by everything from your utility bills on through to your salary and administrative expenses, your meals and entertainment, your shipping, your postage. Those are all going to chew down on that gross margin. Okay? The main thing about these ratios, as in all of the stuff that I'm going to talk about, is always keep in mind that you should look at changes from year to year in these ratios. So if my gross margin in one year is 80% and my gross margin in the next year falls to 70%, well, I've had a 12.5% decrease in my gross margin. Then you ask, why did that happen? Well, the goods were more expensive an explanation would be, well, my goods went up in price, but I couldn't pass the price increase along to the customers because the customers were highly price elastic. They were very sensitive to price. So you have to, you look at what the change is as a percentage. And then you ask yourself, why did this happen? Ratios mean nothing in and of themselves. They start to mean something in the context of year to year and in the context of the industry you're in. And then you can begin to ask the important question, which we do in finance. This is where we come to the fore. Calculators can do the ratios. Spreadsheets can do the ratios. Accountants can do the ratios even. Okay. But then the big question in finance we ask is why? Is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? How is this going to affect things down the line? So always keep that in mind when you're looking at ratios. They mean very little in and of themselves. Okay, now the other one, that profitability ratio, would be the operating margin. The operating margin is, of course, EBIT, operating income, over sales. And again, the same rule applies. These are not meaningful in and of themselves. They mean something only in context. What is the operating margin doing year over year? How is it changing? And always remember, you do it as a percentage. But also, in this case, you can look at how your gross margin changed relative to your operating margin. That kind of change, you're going to see magnification. How much magnification measures your operating leverage? In other words, what are fixed costs doing to you? What are your fixed costs doing to you? Okay? So you look at that magnification from the gross margin to the operating margin. So understand what I'm telling you is that you are beginning to think in multiple dimensions. You're thinking across time, you're thinking down a financial statement, and you're thinking out along an industry. So it's actually, this is very cool stuff because you are multidimensionally analyzing. Right here, right off the bat, in your introductory finance course, I'm showing that you are multidimensional thinkers in finance. Again, you are thinking across years. How is the percentage changing? You're also thinking down the financial statement. How did the gross margin magnify to the operating margin? So you're thinking in that dimension. And then you're also looking across the industry. What was happening with the ratios of other companies in this same line of business? So there you are. Now we can move on. There are a couple. One that I would actually sometimes do. But the net margin. Now, by the way, the book uses net profit margin, gross profit margin, operating profit margin. Use the shorter terminology. It's just the way we talk. We wouldn't say net profit margin. We'd just say net margin. We might even say net. But we'd say net margin. And that's your net income over your sales. This ratio, in particular, can be all over the board. In some industries, you will see net margins that are in the 20-30% range. In other industries, you'll see net margins that are in the less than 1% range. Story from years ago. Back during the OPEC oil embargo, people were just angry as hell at the oil companies. Just pissed off. But the oil companies fought back. They did a couple of things. It was in the day when you saw really advertising was really in its heyday. There were so many different kinds of cool advertisements. One way that the oil companies battled back against the negativity was through very upbeat, positive commercials, talking about all the ways that they were trying to bring energy to people. And I tell in other classes, in economics classes especially, that back then, back in the 1970s, in the early 70s, I recall vividly the Exxon commercials where they were talking how wonderful the future was going to be. And it was this, here at Exxon, people work and people play at the end of every day. And they were showing all these incredible things, like this giant laser firing down on a deuterium pellet to create fusion. And then they showed these beautiful windmills. They showed these phenomenal openings of these solar arrays, all of those alternative energy sources. They were showing them back in the 1970s to tell people, this is temporary. Don't sweat. We'll get there. And of course, look at all these years later, we're still waiting for those things for various reasons. But one of the advertisements that one of the big oil companies did, a very grave, sober executive type from one of the companies. He was an actor, but he looked like one of the president of the company. He said, did you know that the profit we make off $1 of sales is less than one penny? And he held up a penny. He said, that's right. We make less than a penny off a dollar that you pay us for gasoline. Of course, most people say, oh, bullshit. No, he wasn't lying. The profit margin is that thin on the in that aspect of the hydrocarbons business. But you think about the scale of the operation, how many dollars of revenue they pull in, and then you see how they make profits that are in the billions and billions of dollars. Give you another perspective on this. Have you ever been into a Dollar Tree store? See, I'm a Dollar Tree hoe. I go there for everything. I'm an eBay slut. I'll admit it. I buy cheap. I mean, why buy expensive, you know? And when you go into a Dollar Tree store, think about how in the hell could that store survive? Why in the world is a chain like Aldi's? I hate Aldi's. They throw your food in boxes on the floor, and then they make you pay a quarter for a cart. I know, but I just don't want to pay a damn quarter. How does Walmart, with low, low prices, get by? Think about Walmart. I mean, all the people they pay, all the things that they have to do to keep those stores going. From the time you walk into the parking lot, they got cameras they pay for to see if you get hit by a person in a truck that says, my wife, yes, my dog, maybe, my gun, never. And then you walk into the store, the first thing you hear is, hi! And you look, oh, God, they're hiring dwarfs as greeters now. And they have to deal with all of these people walking in the aisles, leaving their dirty footprints, and the kids defecating on the floors or whatever the hell they do. And all these people, the cashiers they pay, and all of this. How do they do this? Well, let's go back to a Dollar Tree store. If they sold, let's say a store like a Dollar Tree, let's say they sold 150 items in one day, that store would pull in revenue of $150. Okay, now they're going to have to pay some workers, usually one or two at a time, it's typically one, and then they're going to have to pay their utility bills, the rent for the land that they're on. By the time they finished all of their payments, they might clear in that store on one day, let's say $20 profit. Now, isn't that just ridiculous? $20? Now, you take $20 times 360 days times 10,000 stores, and suddenly you see why those are darlings of Wall Street. You understand it? The margin is tiny, but the scale is huge. This is why if you take a course in entrepreneurship from me, I tell you, don't go looking for the Hail Mary, the long bomb, the giant profit off one big sale. Look at all the fortunes that are made with tiny things, trinkets, toys, little candies, stores that barely break even any given day of the week. It is not the margin, it is the scale that matters. You got my point there? So when you see that margin, you say, well, that thing sucks. What happened there?
Did the light burned out?
The light burned out?
It's really bad. Somebody just replaced it on Tuesday.
You know what? This sucks.com. I was looking at it. It was dark. And I said, did I just have a small stroke? Okay. You worry about things. When the lights go out, you know, is that the lights or is that my brain having bleeding in it? Or I got to stop smoking. Okay. Let me see if I can get the. Okay, let's try it this way. Okay. I'm standing there now. Okay. Well, let me give you, just talk one through the ROA, return on assets. And you say it ROA. Return on assets is one of those very interesting, cool ones because you're taking net income and you're dividing it by the total assets. And what would that mean? Essentially, what it's telling you is how much money you're making off your total assets. Let's say you have total assets of $100,000. Your net income for the year is, let's say your net income for the year is $10,000. Okay? That means that your assets, the whole body of your assets, brought you a 10% return for the year. You invested $100,000 in assets, and they brought you in 10% return. That's what it's telling you. And so then the question would be, okay, on a risk-adjusted basis, is that a good return on that investment? You've invested $100,000, and so you have generated for the shareholders that the shareholders claim $10,000. And so essentially you're telling your shareholders, okay, the money we plowed that belonged to you back into the company, we made 10% on it. That's pretty much what you're saying. And so you think of that as actually like you're looking at the return on a security. The security here is your total assets. And then you ask, okay, based upon the risk that we took in this investment in those assets, was that a good return? Was that a good return? Could I have done better on a risk-adjusted basis? Or is that as good as I could have done? Okay, so there you are. Okay, now we can, let's see if I can get this. Document camera. Oh, you know what? Oh, sweet. Give me a second here. Let me find a pen. Yes. Oh, great. I just stabbed a hole in my pants with the pen. No, it's not going to kill me, but if it's any comfort to you, that hurt like hell. Let me see if I got any paper I can write on here. Oh, okay. There we go. Be able to get through this exercise here. Okay. Okay. Is that blurry or is that just too much coffee I've had today? It's ROA is net income. Oh. You know, this is just going downhill. It's like... Oh. Oh, I know what's wrong. Is there some reason why this sucks? Why aren't these lights coming? Oh, great. Now it's just showing clear. I'm not ready to call class yet, but it's like... Yeah, do you mind, really? Thank you. God, let me get on with this now. Oh, yeah, that's really... Okay. Just read the damn thing. And no, I don't abbreviate assets. Now, the companion, these are still the profitability ratios. The companion one is your net income over your shareholders' equity. Let me put total shareholders' equity. Boy, that sucks. Oh, yeah, who's good? Now, the net income over total shareholders' equity essentially tells you the money your shareholders have at stake in the corporation. Their total of claims on the corporation. How much did you earn for them as a percentage on that? How much of the percentage did you earn on that? Now, you have to remember, though, that this one is a book ratio. To the extent that that total shareholders' equity thing right there, that's really just telling you, in a historical sense, the accumulation of net incomes and what stocks sold at. So it's not a wildly great ratio, but one thing that you often will see is a comparison of ROA to ROE. Ideally, your ROE, of course, is going to be higher. Your ROE should be higher than your ROA, because total shareholders' equity should be smaller than total assets. You see why that is? Because total assets are total liabilities plus shareholders' equity. So shareholders' equity should be only a part of total assets. So ROE should be higher than ROA. And sometimes some analysts like to compare, well, what's the gap between the ROA and the ROE? I've never been too much of a fan of it, but for some reason I do it anyway. I don't know why, but it's just one of the things you do, and you just kind of look at it and you say, well, is there something interesting there? Usually there's not, but sometimes there is, especially if that gap changes. If from 1 year to the next, if the gap changes, that will be one of those flags. Let's look a little deeper and see why that gap between ROA and ROE shifted the way it did. But there you are. Now, the liquidity ratios. The liquidity ratios start with the quick ratio. And I used to call this the Q, or the quick ratio. I'm sorry, I want to start with the current, the C. Current, I apologize, I'm getting out ahead of myself here. The current ratio is your current assets over your current liabilities. Now, I need to bring something up here. Those first ratios I gave you, the profitabilities, those are all percentages. You should write those as percentages. And remember the rule for my house. It's 2 decimal places rounded as a percentage. So all of the profitability ratios are percentages. You should express them as such on a quiz or an exam to the right number of decimal places. Now, these ratios I'm giving you, these liquidity ratios, they are factors. So after one of these, you don't write a percent, you write a times symbol. Because essentially, like in this current ratio here, that's current assets over current liabilities. That's how many times over your current assets could pay your current liabilities. How many times over? Like your current assets are 30,000 and your current liabilities are 10,000, your current ratio would be 3 times. Your current assets can pay your current liabilities 3 times over. 3 times over. Obviously, you would like that. You definitely want that current ratio to be above 1. It doesn't necessarily have to be, but it's a real danger sign if it isn't above 1. You know why? Why would that be? Why would it be? Because you can't pay your current bills with your current what you got that's currently available. That's a bad sign. Here's one. The next one, the Q ratio, called the quick ratio. Or in my day, we call it the acid test. The acid test is your current assets minus your inventory over your current liabilities. Now, the reason we take out inventory is because it's probably not worth a dime. If you had to have a fire sale, you're not going to get hardly anything. So if you really had to pay off all of your current bills right now, how much money could you raise, really? Because you're not going to get anything for your inventory if you have to sell it today. Who's going to buy it today? Even if someone buys it today, it's going to be pennies on the dollar. And again, it's a multiplier. Okay, suppose that $30,000 in current assets, $10,000 of it is inventory. You got $20,000 now, $30,000 minus $10,000, $20,000 over $10,000. So your acid is going to be 2 times. If you have to pay off all your current bills today, but you're not going to get anything for your inventory, you can do it 2 times over. Now, here's the one that they don't bring up in the book. This one is what we used to call the burn ratio or the burn test. This one... All you're looking at is what you know you can raise. How much there is that you know you can raise. Cash plus marketable securities. Nothing else. Because you really, really, in the real world, you're not going to sell your accounts receivable today. You're not going to sell your prepaid expenses today. You're not going to do any of that. The only thing you've got at the end of the day to cover your ass, if you had to pay off all your current liabilities today, is what you got in the bank and what you can sell through your broker that's liquid. So the burn ratio is essentially the bottom line. It's interesting to me that most of modern textbooks, finance textbooks, don't even bring this one up anymore. You have to go back to the old school stuff to see this one. And I really like this one because this is the one I calculate. I don't really give a rat's ass about the current ratio and the Q ratio because I want to know what's the fire sale going to do. You'll find out that in many cases, not in all cases, the burn is going to be below 1. So if it really came down to it, this company couldn't cover its ass today. And go through a few companies. If you have a chance this weekend, it's not hard to do these ratios. As a matter of fact, a lot of places, they publish the ratios for you. They won't probably publish the burn ratio for you, but you can calculate it. Just look at cash and marketable securities on the balance sheet and divide it by the current liabilities. You'll find out in many cases, most corporations couldn't do a fire sale and save their asses. It's just the way it is these days. Now, there's one more point that I want to make before I move on here. This goes back to that thing about comparative analysis that I've already harped about a couple of times here today. Is with these ratios, when you look at the current Q and burn, or the current asset and burn, you can see fluctuation from year to year. They'll go up and down. What you want to look at is if you have a chance to get maybe about 3, 4, 5 years of data, look for pattern. And that's what we'll do in financial analysis, is we'll look for a pattern of trend. Because then this is that thing I mentioned before, where we can peek inside of the corporate meetings. The ones that we don't hear about publicly. We can see, okay, we've noticed that over a period of time, their current ratio has been getting lower. Well, what would that mean? Okay, it looks to me like their current ratio is getting lower. That tells me that they're trying to thin out their current assets relative to current liabilities, which means that they're moving more towards a fixed assets environment. Okay, let's see if we can confirm that. Let's look at the acid test. Is it trending in the same way? If it is, that confirms for us. Now let's look at the burn ratio and see what's going on there. If they are thinning out their cash and marketable securities, clear down to that, if that ratio is sliding downward, then that confirms for us that this is a company that in possibly some sense is maturing. It's moving towards more of a fixed base than it would have in an earlier time. Now, in the 1990s especially, there was a real fetish let me ask you this. Are you familiar with a term called just-in-time inventory management? There was a real fetish for getting it so that you didn't have any inventory on the shelves. Inventory arrived just in time for you to use it to produce something to sell. That was a real fetish back in the 90s, and they had gotten it from the Japanese. But there were, you saw, sure enough, the current ratio was falling, the current ratios of manufacturing companies were falling, the quick ratios were falling very fast, as they were no longer had large-scale inventory at any given point in time, and the acid tests were really dropping through the floor. So you saw that fetish, and then you saw it back off somewhat in the early 2000s, and then you saw it pick back up again. Obviously, if the Japanese do it this way, we should do it this way because they're so successful. It turned out that wasn't a good idea. That just-in-time inventory system wasn't all that hot. So just have a look at the trends in these and see what your company is doing as far as its short-term asset management goes. It's not just one of these. You have to look at all of them, and you have to look at them over time. And then you can see something about asset management. We will finish this course by talking about asset management and asset management philosophy. Were you taught in accounting the old rule, your current assets should match to your current liabilities, you should finance current assets with current liabilities, finance long-term assets with long-term liabilities? Did they teach you that? Okay, that was an old thing that they used to teach. It's not true. It's still a good idea to kind of be that way, but in real world asset management, which I will show you at the end of this semester, you can see a considerable amount of deviation, but I just wanted to make sure I address that in case any of you have ever heard it. Okay, debt ratios. We'll get into this again. There's debt to total assets. Which is, not surprisingly, debt divided by total assets. Now here I caution. I caution you because I'm speaking from getting my own butt burned on this one, not paying attention. When you look at debt, you look at the long-term debt. It'll be there in the balance sheet just yelling at you, look at me. But you also should include notes payable. I will anticipate that you can do that. When I give you financial statements to do on a quiz or an exam, don't ignore the notes payable. That's part of the debt. Quite a few companies will shift between long-term debt and intermediate-term debt, notes payable. As I had told you in one company's case, they were zero long-term debt, so the debt to total assets was zero. Well, what I was missing was that they had suddenly started taking on notes payable. And I was missing the point that they were starting to leverage, but they were starting to leverage intermediate. Now, what you're looking at here is when you calculate this, you're going to get a percentage. This will be a percentage. Okay? Now, however, the term we use for this is capital structure. Capital structure. What is a company's balance between financing with debt and financing with equity? So that brings us to the second ratio. Now, the debt to total assets will be between 0% and 100%. 0% would be a company that uses no debt in its capital structure. 100% would be a company that uses all debt in its capital structure. We'll get back to that point in a couple of lectures with the Modigliani-Miller proposition. But let me go to the next one. Interestingly, even though the debt to total assets sort of makes more sense just as something to quote, while debt to total assets is 40%. Oh, I'm getting off the screen here. Debt to equity is your debt over total shareholders' equity. This one is more popular to quote. This one can vary between zero and infinity. And this is at the heart of what we mean by capital structure. So if I were to tell you that a company is 20% debt and 80% equity, the debt to equity would be 1-4. Yeah, 1-4. Honestly, there's not a standardized way of doing this. I say it 1-4, but you'd hear other analysts say it's 0.25. One way or the other, I'm almost at a loss as to how to tell you to proceed on this. Debt to total assets makes more sense, a percentage of your total assets that you're financing with debt. But the one that seems to be more popular to say, well, debt to equity is 1-4 or something like that. You reduce the fraction down to its lowest common lowest terms and all of that. But what we're doing here, again, though, is we're measuring the capital structure of the corporation. Now, in a few lectures, we're going to get around to talking about why the balance between debt and equity is important. But as a window on that, that debt to equity is important because if you don't get the debt to equity right, your overall cost of capital is not as low as it could be. Debt is actually very cheap capital up to a point. After a certain point, it starts to get kind of expensive because you're putting your company at risk of default. So up to a certain point, you're going to want to just get more debt. Where is that point where you have gotten enough debt and you should be financing with equity? And we'll spend a few weeks in the course analyzing that whole deal right there. But moving along here, and just bring up a few more. Now, the book goes through, and let me look here. Oh, yeah, the book does one that I'm not going to talk about in this class. It's your average collection period. Finding your total credit sales is a pain in the ass. I won't do that one, but there are a couple of other ones that let me see what they call them. Yeah. I call them activity ratios. The book, I think, calls them asset activity ratios. There's the inventory turnover ratio. Which simply tells you how many times over is your inventory generating sales. Sales. Okay, let's try some. Yeah, let me do it this way. Yeah, thank you. Okay. Sales over inventory. And this is one of those that has beside it a time symbol. How many times over is your inventory producing sales? Now, you might think, well, the higher, the better. Here would be the logic there. If you can make a small amount of inventory turn into a big amount of sales, that's just peachy, yes? Not always. The higher the better, because it could be to the point where you're actually, in terms of sales and administrative expenses, you could be working on such thin inventory that you're paying a lot of money just to have stuff delivered to you just in time. There's another danger too. And this is the danger that finally convinced some companies that that whole Japanese system wasn't a very good idea. What happens if you are in a position where you bring in inventory just in time for a sale? Okay, that would mean that if that supplier suddenly isn't able to do it, you've lost the sale. You create a bottleneck in a just-in-time system, you can have an absolute disaster on your hand. Now, here was the other ugly, ugly side of that whole idea that inventory ratio, in turnover ratio, let's get it through the roof. Let's go to thin, thin inventory, spending no money on stuff on the shelves. We'll just bring in a car door when we need a car door to make a car. The auto manufacturers got to the point where they had gotten their suppliers. If you want to be our supplier, you have to put your facility in our ring, right around our factory, so that you can just bring it right over to us as we need it. And so you had these rings of industrial development with the core of a car manufacturer in the middle. Awesome. And, well, that's just like how the Japanese do it. But you see, there's a difference. What happens if the core of that whole operation suddenly goes tap city? A car manufacturer that suddenly goes bankrupt. you have essentially a black hole that swallows up an entire industry because the suppliers, they've just moved in. They, and forgive my terminology, they have committed themselves to being General Motors' bitch. Now, I wouldn't say, well, yes, I would say that to their faces. That's why they never hire me as a consultant. Do you see what happens, though, when you commit that much power to a core as a supplier? If the core goes under, it's just like a domino effect, and everything around it, physically and financially, comes down with it. So there you are. Anyway, that's the inventory turnover ratio and the total asset turnover ratio. Is sales over total assets. How many times are you turning your total assets in a given year? Suppose your assets, your sales are $100,000. Your total assets are $50,000. Essentially, in some sense, and I don't want you to take this too literally, you really are actually, you're saying, okay, my total assets, I turned those into sales two times over this year. Now, again, here, the higher, the better, not necessarily. Because what you can get, if it's obviously lower isn't wonderful, but through the roof can signal actually a problem. And I found companies where I saw this happening where essentially, the sales over total assets were going up, up, up every year. So that sounds like you are making your assets work more and more efficiently year over year. Okay, that sounds like what it's doing. But what if that is a signal that you are not improving and investing in your asset base? You're essentially just milking the assets and you're not keeping them fresh, keeping them maintained. You could make your total asset turnover ratio go up every year doing that. But at what cost? I'll tell you what cost. Let me give you the example of the oil refining business in the United States. Did you know that as far as oil refineries go, and I can't say this for this year that's just passed, but no new oil refineries had been built in the United States since the late 1970s. Did you know that? The same oil refineries have been being used to crack that oil into the hydrocarbon products that we love so much, the gasoline, the distillates, and all of that, without any new physical plant and equipment being put online, without hardly any adequate maintenance being put into place on those refineries in all that time. So lo and behold, do you remember the over and over again in the last 5 years, an oil refinery has exploded? That's why we had the price of gas go up. Yeah, they just keep blowing up because they're so old, they're worn out. They're just tired. Because they haven't been replaced, they haven't been improved in all those years. Sure, you saw the total asset turnover ratio going up smartly every year. More sales on the same base of total assets. And there you go. There's the other side of it. You do that too long, you're just going to burn out your equipment. You do that too long, and you're telling me you're not investing in new technologies, are you? You're just milking your old dog stuff. So I am not a big fan of that thing going up and up and up. I ask myself, why is it going up? Are they being more efficient with their assets, or are they just beating their old assets into the ground and sooner or later they're going to pay the piper? That's what I usually find out, is with these companies, they're just not properly investing. And that's something I've had an argument with some financial analysts, mutual fund analysts. They, oh, the higher the better. Bullshit. Look at the numbers. They are milking their assets. Sooner or later, they'll pay the price. Those assets are going to just start breaking down, and they're going to be standing there saying, well, spank me, Jesus. Maybe we should have invested in some new technology. No, I'm not opinionated. Nah. Market ratios. No, here it is. Hang on. Let me make sure I'm right. Okay, now the book, on page 117, the book does one called Market to Book Value Ratio. If you ever do that, and I catch you, if you ever do that ratio, I will give you a wedgie. I promise it will be a turbo wedgie. Don't. Book value means nothing at all. Don't use that ratio. The market ratio that really I like, and we talk about it all the time, it's a fun ratio, is what we call the PE ratio, or the price to earnings ratio. But you'll hear me call it the PE, or the PE ratio. It's the market price per share of the stock of the company divided by the earnings per share of the company. So you take the earnings of the company, look down at the bottom line on the income statement, divide that by the number of shares outstanding. That'll give you your EPS. And you use that as the denominator, and in the numerator, you use the market price per share of the stock. Now let me point out here, there's two versions of this ratio. There is the one that is typically used using the outstanding shares. And then there's the what we call the fully diluted PE. In other words, you look at not the outstanding shares, but how many shares could be outstanding if everyone exercised their option. So you want to have a look. I don't worry a huge amount about fully diluted, but it's one of those, well, what would happen if all the executives cashed in and all that kind of stuff, their options? It's usually not much different, not much. So for the most part, just worry about the one, market price per share divided by the earnings per share, and you find the earnings per share by just taking the total earnings divided by the shares outstanding. Now let me tell you what this one means. It has a lot of use. It's very useful, even though it uses in its denominator a non-market number. It has some. It's kind of a fascinating number. Here's what this guy means. When you buy a share of stock, you're going to pay a price that is being established in a very objective fashion. Just millions and millions of trades by hundreds and hundreds of thousands, in some cases, traders battling back and forth, pushing the price this way and that way. So that market price is a discovered price through arm's length objective dealing. It truly is the fair market price, for lack of a better word. It tells us what the price per share is, what investors right now are willing to pay for one share of ownership in that company. So we could say, okay, take a simple example. Suppose that there are 1,000 shares outstanding in a company. The price per share of this stock is $20. The first thing that I could say is, well, the market cap is $20,000. In other words, the value of this corporation is $20,000, the market cap. The market is saying this company is worth $20,000. Don't ever believe these analysts, well, this stock price is undervalued. How in the hell, with billions of dollars flowing every day from millions of traders having access to ungodly flows of information, could there possibly be something like that? Undervalued? the instant something is undervalued, there are thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of predators diving on it, bidding the price up as they try to buy shares of the undervalue. It ain't going to happen. That is the true market price of that company. The value of the company is $20,000. Now, I've bitched about that. Let me go on. Suppose that the earnings of this company, the total earnings at the bottom line for this company were, let's say, $10,000. Okay. So the earnings per share in this case would be $10,000. Oops, sorry, one extra zero there. Divided by 1,000 shares. So the earnings per share for this company were $10 per share. The EPS was $10. The price per share is $20. So let me take the price divided by the earnings per share, the PE ratio, okay? That would be $20 divided by $10, which is 2. In other words, the investment community, the global investment community, is willing to pay $2 for a claim on $1 of current earnings in the company. Let me say that again. The price to earnings ratio here comes out to be 2. That means that the investors worldwide are willing to pay $2 for the claim of $1 of current earnings. Now, why would they do that? It's easy. They would do that because they have assessed that that $1 the company has earned per share is going to multiply to be $2 in present value of future investments. If the price-to-earnings ratio were 10, that would say that investors now hold, in their best judgment, objectively, that $1 of current earnings is worth $10 in present value of future earnings. Do you follow me on this? You have to say it a few times, and I promise I'll ask this on an exam as an essay question. You say it clearly and concisely. Now, do you see that as the price-earnings ratio goes up, you are looking at more risk in an investment? Okay, I'm going to buy a stock with a price-earnings ratio of 5. Or I'm going to buy a stock with a price-earnings ratio of 40. You see that price-earnings ratio of 40? You're betting that a dollar the company earns now is going to turn into $40? That's a long bet. See, back in the day, back in my time, we got a little bit fussy when the price-earnings ratios got up to 15 or 20. Now, okay. You see, for example, in Japanese stock markets, I guess there was one example of a price-earnings ratio, a P.E. ratio, that was over 1 million. I can still show you stocks here in the United States that have P.E. ratios of in the thousands. Many of the most reputable stocks you buy, they have P.E. ratios between 35 and 100. That's considered risky, but in today's standards, it's cool. It's all cool. Well, that's all I have for you today. I thank you.